It is not clear whether the, quote, federal police who visited Hank and Wanda were in fact FBI men or whether they were ever properly identified. If the FBI did interview Killam, there is no indication in the 26 volumes or the Warren Report. A check of the index to commission documents in the National Archives reveals no mention of Killam. But then a number of FBI documents relating to the assassination are withheld, along with most of the documents prepared by the CIA. What is clear is that somebody considered Hank Killam a very important guy.
Witness number 7, William Whaley, last name W-H-A-L-E-Y. Head-on collision. Whaley was the Oswald cabbie, one of the few who had the opportunity to talk alone with the accused killer of Kennedy between the assassination and Oswald's arrest. He testified that Oswald hailed his cab at the Greyhound bus station, then graciously offered the cab to a waiting lady who declined his offer. Now, take note of the fact that if he had just assassinated the president, you wonder whether he'd be that free with his time, you know, saying, after you, ma'am, okay? But keep in mind, officially, this guy just killed the president. Whaley said he drove Oswald to the intersection of Beckley and Natchez, or N-E-C-H-E-S, half a block from the rooming house, and collected a dollar. Now, keep in mind, he took a cab here. Now, that's going to contrast sharply with other versions here that say he drove. This is the essence of the controversy here. Later, he identified Oswald as his fare in a questionable police lineup. Although police records are confused, then he may have picked out another man. Whaley was killed in a head-on collision on a bridge over the Trinity River on December 18, 1965. His passenger was critically injured. The 83-year-old driver of the other car was also killed. Whaley had been with the City Transportation Company since 1936 and had a perfect accident record. He was the first Dallas cabbie to be killed on duty since 1937. When Penn Jones went to interview the general manager of the cab company about Whaley's death, he was literally pushed out of the office. "If you're smart," said the manager, "you won't be coming around here asking questions," unquote.
Witness number 8, Edward Benavides, shot dead. Domingo Benavides, a dark, slim auto mechanic, was a witness to the murder of Officer Tippett, who testified that he, quote, really got a good view of the slayer. He was not asked to see the police lineup in which Oswald appeared. Although he later said the killer resembled newspaper pictures of Oswald, he described the man differently. Quote, "I remember the back of his head seemed like his hairline sort of went square instead of tapered off. It kind of went down and squared off and made his head look flat in the back." Domingo reports he has been repeatedly threatened by police and advised not to talk about what he saw. In mid-February 1964, his brother Eddie, who resembled him, was fatally shot in the back of the head in a beer joint on 2nd Avenue in Dallas. Police quickly picked up Radford Lee Hill, age 41, who confessed almost eagerly. He was a, quote, "hired killer," one officer said. Sentenced to 6 years for manslaughter, Hill was back on the streets in 20 months. Domingo's father-in-law, J.W. Jackson, was so unimpressed with the police investigation of Eddie's death that he launched a little inquiry of his own. 2 weeks later, Jackson was shot at in his home. The assailant secreted himself in the carport, fired once into the house, and when Jackson ran outside, fired one more time, just missing his head. As the gunman clambered into an automobile in a nearby driveway, Jackson saw a police car coming down the block. The officer made no attempt to follow the gunman's speeding car. Instead, he stopped at Jackson's house and spent a long time inquiring what had happened. Later, a police lieutenant advised Jackson, quote, "You'd better lay off this business. Don't go around asking questions. That's our job." Jackson and Domingo are both convinced that Eddie's murder was a case of mistaken identity and that Domingo, the Tippett witness, was the intended victim.
Number 9, Dorothy Kilgallen. Miss Kilgallen was the first to make the public existence of Aquilla Clemens, a witness to the Tippett killing whose name does not appear once in the Warren Report or volumes. She was also the only reporter ever to interview Jack Ruby privately since the killing of Oswald. During the Ruby trial, which she covered for the now-defunct New York Journal-American, Judge Joe B. Brown granted her 30 minutes alone with Ruby in the judge's chambers. The other reporters were furious. One of the biggest scoops of Miss Kilgallen's career came when she pirated the transcript of Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission and ran it in the journal American. Interrupting here, we're going to present you with part of that testimony next week, and I think you're going to find it most amazing. And when you hear that testimony, keep in mind that it's been public since 1964, that the first person to make this public was columnist and What's My Line panelist Dorothy Kilgallen. That was an old quiz show that was very popular many years ago. She was part of the panel on that. Okay, returning now to the account here of Miss Kilgallen and her death. One of the biggest scoops of Miss Kilgallen's career came when she pirated the transcript of Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission and ran it in the journal American. Thousands of New Yorkers were shocked at the hopelessly inept questioning by Chief Justice Warren, by Warren's almost deliberate failure to follow up the leads Ruby was feeding him. Miss Kilgallen died in her bed on November 8, 1965. Dr. James Luke, L-U-K-E, a New York City medical examiner, said the cause of death was, quote, acute barbiturate and alcohol intoxication, circumstances undetermined, unquote. Dr. Luke said there were not high enough levels of either alcohol or barbiturates to have caused death, but that the two are additive, unquote, and together are quite enough to kill. This cause of death, he observed, is not at all uncommon. Was it suicide, accident, murder? Dr. Luke said there was no way of determining that. As we say, Dorothy Kilgallen probably does not belong on any list of Kennedy-related deaths. This is the editor's opinion. Many since then have come to very different conclusions. But questions do remain. An editor of Screen Stars magazine, Mary Branum, B-R-A-N-N-U-M, says she received a phone call a few hours before Dorothy's body was discovered, announcing that she had been murdered. Miss Kilgallen's What's My Line makeup man said that shortly before her death, she vowed she would, quote, crack this case, unquote. And another New York showbiz friend said Dorothy told him in the last days of her life, quote, in 5 more days, I'm going to bust this case wide open, unquote.
Number 10, Lee Bowers, automobile accident. Lee Bowers' testimony is perhaps as explosive as any recorded by the Warren Commission. He was one of 64 known witnesses to the president's assassination who thought shots were fired from the area of the grassy knoll. The knoll is west of the Texas School Book Depository. And I should just say parenthetically, for those of you who do not know, shots from the grassy knoll would be shots striking the presidential car from the front and striking John F. Kennedy from the front, which would explain why the Parkland doctors thought that the wound in the throat was an entrance wound. It would explain Kennedy being slammed back against the seat, and it would explain a lot of other inconsistencies with the ballistic evidence and the single bullet theory. But of course, this is not what the Warren Commission subscribed to. Anyway, going on. Lee Bowers was one of the 64 known witnesses to the president's assassination who thought shots were fired from the area of the grassy knoll. But more than that, he was in a unique position to observe some pretty strange behavior in the knoll area during and immediately before the assassination. Bowers, then a tower man for the Union Terminal Company, was stationed in his 14-foot tower directly behind the grassy knoll. As he faced the assassination site, he could see the railroad overpass to his right front. Directly in front of him was a parking lot, and then a wooden stockade fence and a row of trees running along the top of the grassy knoll. The knoll sloped down to the spot on Elm Street where Kennedy was killed. Police had, quote, cut off traffic into the parking area, Bowers said, quote, so that anyone moving around could actually be observed. Bowers made 2 significant observations, which he revealed to the commission. First, he saw 3 unfamiliar cars slowly cruising around the parking area in the 35 minutes before the assassination. The first 2 left after a few minutes. The driver of the second car appeared to be talking into, quote, a mic or a telephone. He was holding something up to his mouth with one hand and he was driving with the other. This is Bowers being quoted. A third car with out-of-state plates and mud up to the windows probed all around the parking area. Bowers last remembered seeing it about 8 minutes before the shooting, pausing, quote, just above the assassination site. He gave detailed descriptions of the cars and their drivers. Bowers also observed 2 unfamiliar men standing on top of the knoll at the edge of the parking lot within 10 or 15 feet of each other. Quote, one man, middle-aged or slightly older, fairly heavy set in a white shirt, fairly dark trousers. Another younger man, about mid-20s, in either a plaid shirt or a plaid coat or jacket. Both were facing toward Elm and Houston, where the motorcade would be coming from. They were the only strangers he remembered seeing. His description shows a remarkable similarity to Julia Ann Mercer's description of two unidentified men climbing the knoll. When the shots rang out, Bauer's attention was drawn to the area where he had seen the two men. He could still make out the one in the white shirt. Quote, the darker-dressed man was too hard to distinguish from the trees. He observed, quote, some commotion at that spot. Quote, something out of the ordinary, a sort of milling around, which attracted my eye for some reason which I could not identify. At that moment, he testified, a motorcycle policeman left the presidential motorcade and roared up the grassy knoll straight to where the two mysterious gentlemen were standing behind the fence. The policeman dismounted, Bowers recalled, then after a moment climbed on his motorcycle and drove off. Later, in a film interview with attorney Mark Lane, he explained that the, quote, commotion that caught his eye may have been a flash of light or smoke, unquote. His information dovetails with what other witnesses observed from different vantage points. On the morning of August 9, 1966, Lee Bowers, now the vice president of a construction firm, was driving south from Dallas on business. He was 2 miles from Midlothian when his brand new company car veered from the road and hit a bridge abutment. A farmer who saw it said the car was going 50 miles an hour, a slow speed for that road. There were no skid marks to indicate braking. Bowers died of his wounds at 1 p.m. in a Dallas hospital. He was 41. There was no autopsy and he was cremated soon afterward. Doctors saw no evidence that he had suffered a heart attack. A doctor from Midlothian who rode in the ambulance with Bowers noticed something peculiar about the victim. Quote, he was in a strange state of shock, the old doctor said. Quote, a different kind of shock than an accident victim experiences. I can't explain it. I've never seen anything like it. Bowers' widow at first insisted to Penn Jones, that is the person who put together this account, that there was nothing suspicious about her husband's death. Then she became flustered and said, quote, they told him not to talk.
Well, this, again, as with the two witnesses linking Tippett and Oswald to the Tippett killing, as with the single bullet theory, we're not going out of our way here to present you with information which is uncharacteristically, clashes uncharacteristically with the Warren Commission. This is typical. There have been so many strange deaths connected with the investigation of the Kennedy assassination, going right up to the House Select Committee itself. There were many, many people called to testify in front of the House Select Committee in the mid and late 1970s who were deep-sixed in similar fashion. George de Morenshield, generally believed to be Oswald's intelligence babysitter and certainly a reactionary white Russian, a reactionary aristocrat. He, just before an interview with a Dutch journalist, he basically kissed the muzzle of a shotgun, and unfortunately it went off in his mouth, blew off the back of his head. William Sullivan, head of Division 5 of the FBI, the Internal Security Division, just before his testimony, and here's a man who's been handling firearms his whole life, he had a strange hunting accident, and that resulted in his death. And, again, as above, so below. The pattern we're indicating here is typical. We're not going out of our way to make a case, and that's a point I think we should stress here.
Indeed.
All right, now, very briefly, one aspect of the controversy surrounding the assassination of President Kennedy concerns the investigation that was opened in 1967 by New Orleans, I guess 66 is when it began, at New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison. Now, Jim Garrison has received essentially the same kind of treatment through the media that a lot of the witnesses received at the hands of person or persons unknown. Basically, he's been not literally assassinated, but he's undergone character assassination and defamation ad infinitum. His whole effort has been ridiculed, and incorrectly so. Basically, Garrison had uncovered a major part of the conspiracy to murder President Kennedy. I don't think anyone at this point could, with the probable exception of Mae Russell, could say for sure whether he had uncovered most of it. But he'd uncovered the core of the conspiracy. And by the way, Mae Russell, whose weekly cassette series is aired every week here on KFJC on Sunday mornings, as Nip mentioned at the top of the program, she is the greatest researcher of the Kennedy assassination. She was one of Jim Garrison's investigators. She actually went to New Orleans and worked with Garrison for some time. Now, basically, Garrison uncovered a number of interesting things concerning Oswald's connections in New Orleans. First of all, last week, you'll recall, we noted that Lee Harvey Oswald was the only member of the New Orleans chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and literature that he passed out on the Fair Play for Cuba Committee listed its address as 544 Camp Street. Now, 544 Camp Street was an entrance to a building on a corner on Another street, 531 Lafayette Place, had another entrance to the same building. In other words, 531 Lafayette Place and 544 Camp Street both offered entrances to the same second-story walk-up apartment. Now, Lee Harvey Oswald ostensibly was using this for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and this is interesting because the office was shared by an alleged detective service, which appears to have been actually a right-wing paramilitary front operated by a guy named Guy Bannister. Guy Bannister had headed up the Chicago FBI office for quite some time, and then he moved down to New Orleans, where he was, I believe, assistant, their deputy chief of police for many years, and eventually he went on to become a right-wing paramilitary organizer, published something called the Louisiana Intelligence Digest, which a racist publication which made integration out to be some sort of a communist conspiracy. And Guy Bannister had a whole stable of investigators in this far right-wing office, which alleged leftist Lee Harvey Oswald was known to frequent. And one of the people who worked in his office was a man named David Ferry. Now, David Ferry had worked for the CIA on the Bay of Pigs in a number of other capacities. He also worked as a private pilot and did other tasks for Carlos Marcello, who was capo mafioso for New Orleans. And last week we looked at a statement by Marcello. Basically, he uttered an ancient Sicilian death oath against the Kennedys and said that John Kennedy was going to be assassinated and that a nut would hire the job. Keep in mind the Ferry-Marcello connection. Now, when Oswald was arrested, he had David Ferry's library card, active library card, in his possession. Now, the FBI then questioned Ferry, who had taken a strange, had driven all night through a driving rainstorm from Louisiana to Texas, ostensibly to go ice skating in Houston. And a lot of people found this drive and the motivation for it very strange. And since Ferry was an expert pilot associated with civilian air patrol and a number of other things, they speculated that he might have been involved in attempting a getaway. Now, there's a whole connection with regard to library cards. The FBI asked Ferry if he had his library card. He produced an expired card. And there's a whole library connection, which if people want to know about it, we can talk about it in the phone-in section. Now, very briefly, a witness was uncovered by Garrison named Perry Raymond Russo. And Russo testified that he saw David Ferry, Leon Oswald, and a guy named Clay Shaw plotting an assassination of President Kennedy in which he would be killed. That Kennedy, that is, would be killed from ambush. And there was talk of a need for triangulation of fire and sacrificing one man so the others would escape and so forth. Now, Clay Shaw was a high-ranking U.S. intelligence operative affiliated with a couple of corporate fronts called Permandex and Centro Mondiale Commerciale. We're going to talk about those in the fourth part of the program, or if somebody wants to phone in and ask us about it, we could talk about it a little later. There's an interesting thing that was found in Oswald's and Clay Shaw's notebooks. Oswald, at the time of his arrest, had a post office box 1903 in Dallas in his notebooks, which was interesting because in 1963 there was no post office box 1903. It was a non-existent P.O. box. Now, when a coding key that is found throughout Oswald's notebooks is applied to Post Office Box 1903, keep in mind, a non-existent P.O. box at the time, that P.O. box yields Jack Ruby's unlisted Fort Worth telephone number. Now, that same Post Office Box 1903 was found in Clay Shaw's notebooks, yet another piece of circumstantial evidence leading, you know, linking these individuals. There are a number of other aspects of the physical evidence inclining Garrison to indict these men for a conspiracy to assassinate the president. We can go into that. We'll go into that in the fourth program to an extent, and certainly in response to any listener questions. Now, the important thing for our purposes here about the Garrison investigation is the fact that the jury, which went out to assess the guilt or innocence of Clay Shaw, concluded that there had definitely been a conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy, and this could be verified on the basis of available evidence. They could not, however, come to the conclusion that Clay Shaw was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, okay? They concluded that there had definitely been a conspiracy. They could not convict Clay Shaw beyond a reasonable doubt, so he was acquitted. Now, one of the interesting things is that Garrison encountered all kinds of extraordinary difficulties, a media smear and everything else. One of his most unsurmountable difficulties was the fact that three of the key witnesses that he sought for his case were not extradited, and the circumstances surrounding the Garrison's inability to get them extradited are worth noting. Now, first of all, one of the witnesses who he sought to have testify in his case was a man named Sergio Arcacha Smith, who was one of a number of anti-Castro Cuban exile leaders. And Arcacha Smith was basically, Garrison wanted to question him and filed an extradition request. Then Governor of Texas John Connally, who of course was in the motorcade, who as Secretary of the Navy subsequently downgraded Lee Harvey Oswald's discharge to dishonorable. Keep in mind he supposedly had performed espionage against the United States, was never indicted for that, by the way. And so John Connally refuses to extradite Sergio Arcacha Smith. The second witness, and this is worth noting at great length and in detail, was a man named Edgar Eugene Bradley. Now, Edgar Eugene Bradley was identified by Dallas policeman Roger Craig as a man who identified himself as a Secret Service agent after Craig had stopped a man looking very much like Oswald coming out of the back of the Texas School Book Depository and getting into a station wagon. This, of course, conflicts with other information. Now, I'm getting a little confused. Craig stopped a man and began questioning him. Edgar Eugene Bradley came up to Roger Craig and identified himself as a Secret Service agent and obliged Craig to let the man go. Okay, now Edgar Eugene Bradley was indicted by Garrison, then Deputy California Attorney General, Bradley was an L.A. resident, Charles O'Brien reviewed the extradition request by Garrison, recommended that it be granted. Now, the Bradley extradition request was handled by then-Governor Ronald Reagan's legal counselor, who is Edwin Meese, today a presidential counselor. And Edwin Meese is also a colonel in the Army Reserve, and he is specifically involved in intelligence, which is worth noting. He was Reagan's legal counselor when he was governor. He handled the day-to-day, he oversaw the day-to-day handling of the Edgar Eugene Bradley extradition request. Reagan delayed acting on the request till after Richard Nixon had been elected president, and then Reagan turned down the request without comment. And of course, we commented earlier that all of the figures who won encounters, or most all of the living figures who won encounters in the course of the investigation of the assassination of President Kennedy, have moved on and up. And certainly, we don't need to tell you what happened to Ronald Reagan. Now, the third of the witnesses that Garrison could not get extradited was a man named Gordon Novell, last name N-O-V-E-L. Now, keep his name in mind because we're going to come back to him next week in our discussion of the connections between Kennedy assassination and Watergate. Now, Gordon Novell was connected with a burglary in which a bunch of munitions were secured for the Bay of Pigs and then stored at Guy Bannister's detective office. And Novell was connected with a number of other things with regard to the assassination. Anyway, Garrison sought to question him and to have him extradited. Novell fled to Columbus, Ohio, and then Ohio Governor John Rhodes refused to extradite Gordon Novell unless Garrison, now catch this, Garrison agreed not to question him in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. Now that, of course, was the very case that Garrison sought to question Novell about. And so if you say, well, Garrison had no case, if Novell would have been cleared, why did Rhodes again perform one of these many somersaults that one encounters in connection with the investigation? He agreed to extradite Novell if Garrison would not question him about the case which he was being extradited in connection with.
Absolutely. Ludicrous. Just terrifyingly ludicrous, actually, that people would go for that kind of thing. Now, as we get to the subject, which again, we have only time to touch on rather briefly tonight, of the media participation in the cover-up, an important thing to remember. Now, Dave mentioned in Clay Shaw's trial. Now, Clay Shaw himself, the grand jury found that there was not sufficient evidence to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that Clay Shaw himself was guilty. However, what got very little press play was the fact that the grand jury did find that there was copious evidence of a conspiracy. Now, one of the other things that went on, and this was during the House Select Committee investigation on assassinations, which I believe the report came in 78. Was it 78? 76.
Well, the actual the committee was begun in 76, held public hearings in 78. Its report came out in 79.
Okay, 79. Thank you very much. Anyway, now the House Select Committee on Assassinations, now which very few people remember these days, this only happened 4 years ago, found in favor of a conspiracy to assassinate John F. Kennedy. Now, to give you an idea of how the press deals with these kinds of things, the New York Times, which I'm going to talk to you about in just a moment, the New York Times actually wrote an editorial Now, again, we're not making this stuff up, folks. This happens in America. The New York Times, after this congressional committee specifically put together to study assassinations because of the work of people like Mae Brussels and the other people we've quoted from tonight, this House Select Committee found in favor of a conspiracy. They thought there was a conspiracy to assassinate John F. Kennedy. The New York Times ran an editorial that said, literally, although I'm paraphrasing, said, so what? So there were two lone nuts. So what? Now, if you can deboggle your mind over that concept for a moment, that the New York Times could editorialize that there could be two lone nuts and that it was of no particular significance that these two would just happen to show up in Dealey Plaza, just happen to kill John F. Kennedy on the same day, et cetera, and that there would be no conspiracy or danger of a wider conspiracy involved. If you can deboggle your mind for a moment, we're going to go on with the subject of the media conspiracy just a little bit, and we're going to touch on it. I'm going to read a section here from a book called Government by Gunplay. It's one of the many fine anthologies put together of the work of various researchers. As I mentioned, the title is Government by Gunplay, a subtitle, Assassination Conspiracy Theories from Dallas to Today. It is edited by Sid Blumenthal and Harvey Yazigian, and the introduction is by Philip Agee. Once again, this book is called Government by Gunplay, and the book itself is copyright, and I just dropped my information. It's in 1976, and it's published by Signet Classics in paperback. Now, this section that I'm reading from here is the section called The Second Dallas Casualty, and they're referring to press integrity, is what the author Jerry Polikoff is referring to. That's P-O-L-I-C-O-F-F. And here he is specifically talking about the New York Times. Now, the New York Times, right after the Warren Commission's findings came out, the New York Times took the then unprecedented step of literally printing the entire Warren Commission report. Now, not the testimony, as we mentioned earlier, which is where all the hooks are that bring the downfall of the Warren Commission, but the New York Times excerpted the entire Warren Commission report and printed it verbatim. I think it was like a 40-something page supplement to the New York Times special. The New York Times then steadfastly stood by the Warren Commission, as did Time Incorporated, Life and Time magazines, and things of that nature. The New York Times stood steadfastly by the Warren Commission, going to absurd lengths to try and justify it as more and more holes were punched in the Warren Commission. And that includes things that I'm not going to have time to go into in depth, but in terms of utterly farcical and false, misleading book reviews of books written about the Kennedy assassination, and just a whole number of things to at any cost support the Warren Commission. Well, one of the things they did, 2 months after this release of the entire Warren Commission findings, the New York Times released a supplemental volume, okay, on the Warren Commission itself, and basically putting up the Warren Commission as the greatest thing since sliced bread to happen to American jurisprudence. Anyway, I'm going to read from Jerry Polikoff's description of how the New York Times maneuvered the information that it put together, or at least some of it, in this book. And Polikoff writes as follows in Government by Gunplay. 2 months later, the New York Times followed the Commission's release of the 26 supplemental volumes of hearings and exhibits by collaborating with McGraw-Hill and Bantam Books on The Witnesses. That's the title. A book consisting of, quote, highlights of the hearings before the Warren Commission prepared by, quote, a group of editors and reporters of the New York Times. The witnesses included the affidavit of Arnold Rowland, who stated that he had observed a man with a rifle on the sixth floor of the depository before the assassination. But the witnesses did not include his subsequent testimony, in which he stated he had actually seen two men, that the FBI had told him to, quote, forget it, and his opinion that the shots had come from the railroad yard in front of the president. Omitted from the testimony of amateur photographer Abraham Zapruder was his statement that his immediate reaction was that the shots had come from behind him in front of the president. Similar statements relating an immediate impression that the shots had come from the front were deleted from the excerpted testimony of David F. Powers, a special assistant to the president, and that of Secret Service agent Forrest V. Sorrells. Deleted from the testimony of three other Secret Service agents were the descriptions each gave of a bullet wound in the president's back below the shoulder. The official autopsy report placed the wound at the back of the neck. One of these agents also reported that he was not certain that all of the shots had come from the rear, but this too was omitted from the witnesses. Autopsy Surgeon Commander James J. Humes excerpted testimony, and the witnesses omitted his statement that he had destroyed the draft of the autopsy. And what this book does not mention, Hume also stated, not for public consumption, that he had destroyed his notes of the autopsy, burned his autopsy notes. Going on. The witness admitted his statement that he had destroyed the draft of the autopsy, as well as his verbal gymnastics in reconciling the location of bullet holes nearly 6 inches below the collar in the president's shirt and jacket with the officially designated location of the wound in the neck. Both Humes and Dr. Pierre Fink, F-I-N-C-K, a second autopsy surgeon, voiced skepticism that the nearly pristine bullet found on a stretcher at Parkland Memorial Hospital had hit both Kennedy and Governor Connally. In parentheses, it says, the Warren Commission ultimately concluded that this was indeed the case. But these exchanges also were deleted from the witnesses, as was the portion of the testimony of Nelson Delgado, a friend of Oswald from his Marine Corps days, in which he referred to Oswald's extremely poor marksmanship. The witnesses excluded the testimony of numerous witnesses reporting at least some shots fired from the front. For example, Gene Hill, who reported seeing a man fleeing from the area of the grassy knoll after the shooting, was edited out. The testimony of Wilma Tice and reporter Seth Cantor, who reported seeing, the latter conversing with, Jack Ruby at Parkland Hospital, as well as many others who gave relevant but inconvenient testimony before the Warren Commission, was also left out. In short, a volume purporting to be an objective condensation of relevant testimony compiled by America's newspaper of record, quote-unquote, was little more than deliberately slanted propaganda in support of the Warren Commission report. Now, again, the evidence goes on and on, and the New York Times battle with the forces of truth and goodness goes on at some great length. But the key here, and this occurs all during the media cover-up, is in cases where outright misrepresentation or outright contravention of the facts is not used, what is instead used is selectively excerpted testimony, just as the Warren Commission allowed Arlen Specter to go in and lead the medical witnesses with a bunch of impossible suppositions to saying that given those impossible suppositions, that the impossible was possible. Similarly, the New York Times, in this book, The Witnesses, went ahead and pulled all the testimony that would back the Warren Commission, a teeny smart part of the iceberg, out of the testimony, stuck it in their book, and left out all the testimony that the witnesses had come up with that in many cases just absolutely blew the Warren Commission out of the water.
Worth noting that in 1974, the Pike Committee, a House committee, put together to investigate CIA activities, and specifically CIA involvement with the media, uncovered the fact that the CIA, now check this out, the New York Times has this reputation as the American newspaper. It was revealed that the CIA considers the New York Times its single most valuable propaganda asset. Worth keeping that in mind as you hear about all the news that's fit to print. Okay, very quickly, one of the most amazing aspects of the whole cover-up of the assassination of President Kennedy concerns the extraordinary handling of photographic evidence by major news media. Specifically here, we're going to be talking about Time Life Incorporated. Now, the information that we're selecting here, we're not going out of our way to make a case. This is representative of the preposterous ways and the preposterous lengths to which the Warren Report's defenders have gone in order to make it appear credible. Now, the information I'm going to be reading to you comes from a book called The Yankee and Cowboy War. That was authored by the nominal head of the Assassination Information Bureau in Boston, a man named Carl Oglesby, last name O-G-L-E-S-B-Y. Of his body go in different directions. Many wags have observed that can only happen in a universe which has two suns, a solar system which has two suns, and ours only has one. Now, there are a number of other obviously fraudulent aspects of this particular photograph. This photograph was on the front, was on the cover of Life magazine, and has been reproduced over and over and over. It is an obviously forged photograph.
I just want to mention that Lee Harvey Oswald himself was shown that very self-same photograph in the police station in Dallas, took one look at it and said, this is an obviously forged photograph. He himself had some photographic experience. He said, this is an obviously forged photograph, and as soon as I can basically get a chance to, I can prove that this photograph has been stuck together of two photographs in an attempt to make me look, you know, like a killer.
Okay, and we're also going to take a look at Time Magazine's rearranging of the geography of Dealey Plaza and talking about whether or not there was a gunman on the grassy knoll. Okay, we're going to talk about that in a second. Once again, reading from the Yankee and Cowboy War softcover edition, Berkeley Medallion 1976, author Carl Oglesby writes as follows. Next, take the Life magazine cover photo of Oswald, which appeared on February 21st, 1964. People will find it easy to locate. They will see for themselves what might have been obvious at once to the whole world, and certainly to the photo lovers who put Life and the Warren Report together. Namely, that this is a doctored photo, and more than that, it is a crudely doctored photo and doctored more than once by different hands at different times. At first glance, we simply see Oswald in his battle gear, more encumbered seeming than menacing. In his left hand, with the butt against his thigh, is, possibly, the weapon of the sixth floor. In his right hand, he shows us some literature of the Socialist Workers' Party, the FBI's favorite radical whipping boy. See Hoover's anti-left COINTELPROS, unquote. On his right hip is the pistol with which he is supposed to have slain Patrolman Tippett. But if we notice the shadows on Oswald's face and the shadows his body casts, at once we see that they fall at obviously different angles. The shadow under his nose falls straight down as though the sun were in front of him. All the other shadows in the photo, including the shadow of his body, fall off sharply to his right, behind him as though the sun were to his left. Then we notice how the entire body is standing seemingly at a gravity-defying angle. A still closer look at Oswald's face shows another giveaway. The chin is not Oswald's sharp cleft chin, but a broad, round, blunt chin bearing no resemblance to Oswald's at all. The horizontal line separating the face of Oswald from the rest of the body is also perfectly apparent once one looks. Where did this bogus photo come from? It is said to have been found among Oswald's effects by the Dallas police, who also produced another photo of Oswald armed and similarly doctored, taken with the same camera as the first. No other pictures in the collection had been taken by that camera, nor was that camera found among Oswald's things. But we said it was doctored more than once. The second time was in the photo lab of the Time Life building, where someone unknown but with the authority to do so told an illustrator to paint a telescopic sight on the rifle shown in the photo, something the rifle had when the police presented it to the world after the killing, but not when this picture was taken. What could have possessed Time's editors that they would tamper in the least respect with this critical piece of evidence? But there was to come a third and much worse tampering, again by the specialists of Time Incorporated. In its issue of November 24th, 1975, once more sallying forth to lay all doubts of the lone Oswald theory to rest, Time reprinted this photo, rather, an artfully selected portion of it. For as though to solve the problem of the contradictory shadows, Time cut off the picture at Oswald's knees so there was simply no shadow on the ground to see. And as though to solve the problem of the tilting figure, Time rotated the whole photo a few degrees to the right, aligning the figure vertically, then recropping to straighten the sides and lightly airbrushing the background of fence and houses to obscure the fact that now the background was tilting crazily to the right. What kind of journalism is this? The only possible innocuous explanation is ignorance, and how could ignorance unaided have hit all these hidden bases so squarely? The layout man at Time is not an expert on Dealey Plaza, but surely the writers and editor of that story cannot claim such an excuse. How do we avoid drawing an inference of intentional deception? To top it off, with the same article, Time printed a diagram of Dealey Plaza, which totally mislocated the famous grassy knoll. As every school child to the debate about JFK's death learns on the first day in class, quote, grassy knoll, unquote, is a term used exclusively to refer to the area north of Elm up an incline towards the Triple Overpass. That is, the area to Zapruder's right. But in the Time drawing, the grassy knoll is shown at Zapruder's left, just next to the depository. Could this be another accidental slip? Certainly it is not trivial. The whole debate about JFK's assassination hinges on the shots which Warren's critics say came from this area, the grassy knoll. What gives so much concrete power to this claim is the massive congruity between the president's reaction to the headshot and the response of the crowd. He is thrown backwards, and they, after a moment of shock, surge up the knoll in the direction they thought the shots were coming from. This area, of course, is totally separated from Oswald's supposed perch in the depository at Zapruder's left. But on the other hand, as evidently occurred to someone, if the grassy knoll were next to the depository instead of at the other end of the plaza from it, then the immensity of this problem for the Warren reconstruction of the crime would be lost on the newcomer to the dispute. The newcomer will look at Time's diagram and justly conclude that, since since the grassy knoll and the depository are next to each other, the conflict among the witnesses about the origin of the shots must not be so important. So again, in order to obfuscate the significance of the location of the grassy knoll, they simply moved it. They moved it next to the school book depository to Zapruder's left instead of on his right. A small feat of journalistic legerdemain.
That's right, and they saved the trouble of bringing in the Army Corps of Engineers by only doing it on paper. You know, you got to admire that. I'm going to read one last little short thing, and then we're going to wrap up this section of the program. We're going to go to the phones. We don't have time. The story alone of the cover-up is just incredible, and both of the books we've read from are good sources on the media cover-up. The patently false recreation of the crime that CBS television went through with Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather and other journalistic foursquares involved is terrifying in and of itself. They hired a teams of sharpshooters to try and duplicate Oswald's feat, and after allowing them to practice and throwing out fully half of the times because of trouble with a gun and things like this, you know, they finally came up with some small number of them who some small percentage of the time could equal this feat that Oswald, a poor marksman, supposedly equaled the first time, and they could only do it with a stationary target. It's just absolutely astonishing the length, but CBS used this to conclude that, yes, a lone gunman could have fired all three shots, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, but one more idea. Back on the subject of Life magazine, to give you an idea of what lengths these people went to actually change the story and to at all costs, a supposedly objective news magazine, to at all costs preserve the Warren Commission's integrity or to try and support the Warren Commission story. Let me read you a little section further out of the Government by Gunplay that I read from just a moment ago. Jerry Polakoff's article, The Second Dallas Casualty, again referring to the integrity of the press. And he's talking about the same October 2nd, 1964 photo that the Oswald cover photo was on, I believe, right? The October 2nd, 1964?
February 21st.
Okay. It was again in 64 when the Warren Commission came out, though, so I stand corrected on that. Anyway, reading from Polakoff's work. Life devoted much of its October 2nd, 1964 issue to the newly released Warren Report. Rather than assigning one of its own staff to evaluate the report, Life handed the task to a member of the Warren Commission, Gerald Ford. Aside from employing a member of a government commission to review that commission's work for a supposedly objective feature news magazine, that issue is intriguing for another reason. It underwent two major revisions after it first hit the newsstands, an enormously costly undertaking that required breaking and resetting plates not once, but twice. That issue of Life was illustrated with 8 frames from the Zapruder film, along with descriptive captions. The sixth slide in the original sequence was frame 323, which showed the president slumped back against the seat a half second after his head had been struck by a bullet. The caption read, quote, "The assassin's shot struck the right rear portion of the president's skull, causing a massive wound and snapping his head to one side." Well, this description was in seeming contradiction to the Warren Commission findings that the shot had come from the rear. That version of the October 2nd issue was quickly withdrawn from sale and replaced by a second version, in which frame 313, the frame in which the president's head explodes, was substituted for frame 323. Although this frame gave no hint of the direction in which the president's head was thrown, the caption remained the same and still described the movement, quote, "to one side." Thus, a third version of the October 2nd issue replaced the second. This time, the caption accompanying frame 313 read, quote, "The direction from which the shots came was established by this picture, taken at the instant the bullet struck the rear of the president's head and passing through, causing the front part of his skull to explode forward." The changes in this issue of Life were brought to the attention of Ed Kern, a Life editor, 2 years later by Vincent Salandri, a Philadelphia attorney who was then an active Warren Commission critic. Kern replied, quote, "I am at a loss to explain the discrepancies between the three versions of Life which you cite. I've heard of breaking a plate to correct an error. I've never heard of doing it twice for a single issue, much less a single story. Nobody here seems to remember who worked on the early Kennedy story." Anyway, just an example of how these things were manipulated after the facts. We're going to take a very short musical break for about 4 minutes. Then we're going to be back in the studio with your phone calls at 415-941-2500. Myself, Nip Tuck, Dave Emery, and, of course, our guest, Ted Rubenstein, a former member.